Welcome to MedEvidence, where we help you navigate the truth behind medical research with unbiased, evidence-proven facts, powered by Encore Research Group and hosted by cardiologist and top medical researcher, Dr. Michael Corrin.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Corrin, and I'm very excited to lead another session of Two Docs Talk, which is part of our MedEvidence platform. And I'm particularly excited today because I have a great guest. Dr. Michael Bernhardt is here with me.
Thank you.
Michael and I have known each other for a few years now.
Correct.
Michael is an amazing dermatologist. I trust my own skin to him.
Thank you.
And he's also a great researcher, and I've worked with him in the research realm here at Jacksonville Center for Clinical Research. So we're going to talk about an area that is probably the bread and butter of dermatologists and is something that is now getting a very high-tech spin, and that's the treatment of acne.
Correct.
So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through what is acne, who does it affect, all the basics, and then we'll eventually get to the elements that are really exciting, which is new ways of treating it that may be more effective than what we have now.
What's interesting is that as a dermatologist, the stage we're at in terms of treating acne is kind of similar, in my opinion, to where we were in terms of treating psoriasis back in 2005, 2003, you know, before the biologics had the big impact. And, you know, of course, we did some of the studies here, Taltz, Cosentyx, Salik. All these drugs were huge game changers for psoriasis. And I still think that in a way we're still in kind of a early phase of understanding, even though this is a ubiquitous problem, right? According to the people that are promoting the study, I think that the target range is over 230 million people.
Wow.
That globally with acne. and it creates a lot of morbidity, more than people realize. The physical impact in terms of scarring, psychological impact in terms of state of being, state of mind, particularly in vulnerable teenagers who have self-esteem issues as a rule to begin with. So if something could be done to bring acne care into the 21st century, that would be great.
Yeah, exciting. So let's break it down for our audience. So let's start about the definition of acne and what is the cause of acne.
So acne is an inflammatory condition that affects the sebaceous glands. And the first step is comedone formation. And the analogy—
And before I get to that, so does it just affect the face or is acne everywhere?
It could be charcoal. It could be face, back, chest. It could be small lesions.
Sun exposed or any place doesn't matter.
Anywhere goes. Anywhere there's a follicle is at risk.
Okay.
You know, and the first step is a plugging of the pore. The analogy that I make in the office is I tell people to kind of close their eyes and visualize a Coca-Cola bottle that's about three quarters full of soda. Because just like a soda bottle has a tapering where you screw the cap on, the follicle has a tapering, and that area is called the isthmus.
Okay.
And where the isthmus of the follicle is, the cells will proliferate, choke off the follicle, prevents that fluid, which is not soda, but it's semi-liquid wax or sebum, from coming out of the follicle, lubricating the skin, traps, ruptures, inflames, and you get a lesion.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and we talk about bacteria being an important part of it. So can you explain that a little bit to folks?
So, you know, the skin is not a sterile envelope, which is something I explain to patients all the time. There are fungi, there are viruses, there are bacteria that are normal inhabitants on the human skin. And one of the key players in acne is a bacterium called Propionibacterium acnes, or P. acnes for short. There are several different strains of this organism, and it's been found that one or two strains are particularly pro-inflammatory. And there are particulates of the organism, what they call cell surface markers, as well as what's called opsonizing particles, which are clumping particles. And those are the parts that are the target of this vaccine that we're looking at.
So just a little bit more about the epidemiology. We think of acne as something that teenagers get, but it's more than that. So explain why it's teenagers. Explain a little bit more about other times in life when you're prone to acne, and maybe explain why you are prone to that problem at that time. So why are teenagers more prone, or why other people more prone?
Well, I mean, first off, the myth that it's only a teenager disease, right? 40% of people that are new onset acne patients, women between the ages of 24 and 64. Mm-hmm. So in almost half the patients, it's an adult onset. It is common in teenagers, right? So what plays a role? Obviously, the hormone flux plays a role. And certainly, we know that acne, like in hidradenitis suppurativa, we know that the cells that line the follicular epithelial cells are particularly sensitive to the presence of testosterone or progesterone, and those you know, proto-hormones. Why? There's different reasons that are speculated. We know that in hidradenitis, for example, right, we know that, which is almost a cousin of acne, a more severe cousin of acne, we know that those cells are exquisitely sensitive to testosterone. We know that in that population, there's a high incidence of hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance. We know that in women, for example, there are certain sexually based differences in terms of immune response, killer cells versus T-cell driven responses. How that plays in acne, hasn't really been translated over yet, but at the gut level, I think some of that plays a role. So in the teenage years, when those kids are growing and hormone levels are in a state of flux, sensitivity to the presence of hormones are in a state of flux, causes changes.
Interesting. Yeah. And you said sometimes women at later stages in life are prone to this. How about men? Any time in their life in particular where you see that they're more or less prone?
Mostly teenage in my experience, but I do get older. You know, people post 20.
So there's no menopause that causes acne.
Why is it menopause? It should be girlopause, right? Right? Because it's
it should be the opposite of what you are, right?
Yeah, right.
So, good
interesting
point.
Though, when I practiced for ER in Arizona, big market out there, everybody's on testosterone supplementation for quote unquote overall health. So a lot of nodular cystic acne, even the women, new onset men. So definitely testosterone plays a role.
So guys that may take extra testosterone to live forever or to build their muscle mass, they would be prone to acne.
Yeah, and it could be really tough to treat.
Interesting.
So, especially if they don't want to come off the testosterone.
Okay. So let's pivot a little bit to the treatment element, and we're going to get much more into that. But just from a general sense, so as a general physician, I have knowledge that you use topical things, and then eventually you use antibiotics if it gets bad. So just walk us through that in a very fundamental way.
So treatment is kind of based on what you're seeing. No different than in your field, cardiology. So what's the reality in front of you? So if someone has maybe 5 to 10 small plug pores, what we call closed comedones, right? We're not going to go on systemic therapy for that. So that's the kind of person where you want to exfoliate the skin and modify the lining of the pore. So that's where things like Retin-A, adapalene, all these retinoids. Retinoids are derivatives of vitamin A that are designed to modify the texture and the quality of the follicles.
And that has a big following now for other reasons, Retin-A. I know a lot of people think it helps with wrinkles.
It works.
Does it? Okay.
It works.
I've heard it's been evidence-based to prove that it works for wrinkles as well as acne.
I haven't read the evidence-based data on it. I've just been using it for 40 years, and I've seen it. It definitely works. You can tell who's using it and who's not using it. And it's really a pretty benign drug. You know, when you think of all the drugs that are out there, but it definitely works, smooths out wrinkle lines, but it also exfoliates, kind of modifies the follicle, which I think is probably gut level. I think it's having an effect on fibroblasts. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's been any research into that, but I think that's what's driving a lot of the youthful approach to it. Mm-hmm. But so that's usually step one, is a retinoid, a topical antibiotic, something like topical clindamycin, which drives down the P. acnes population. And also acts as an anti-inflammatory. If someone has a more advanced condition where they start getting little lumpy bumps, you know, we call in dermatology nodular cystic lesions, which in plain English translates into lumpy bumps.
Okay.
Those are the kind
of people. In teenage speak, is that pizza face?
Sure. Sure. It could be tough, though. It could be tough on those kids. So when they come in with the nodular cystic lesions and the excessive oil secretion, which is what's been called pizza face, that's when oral antibiotics come into play. Because for non-inflammatory lesions, antibiotics don't work. I mean, antibiotics work, A, by driving down the propionibacterium acnes. But a lot of these drugs, you know, block metalloproteinases. That's one of the things that doxycycline does, and that's why we use it in rosacea a lot. It's because it downregulates metalloproteinase 8, 9, and 10, which are pro-inflammatory collagenolytic molecules.
Right.
Right. So we're using it as much for anti-inflammatory basis as we are for bacteria kill.
Interesting.
So that's when we use it for the nodular cystic lesions. And if they don't respond to that, that's when you start getting into the world of isotretinoin. Now, the other drug that we're using a lot, particularly in our female population, is spironolactone, mm-hmm. Aldosterone. It is a great hormone blocker. And I started using it a lot more the year I was in Arizona because it was a big treatment out there. And I've brought it back, and we use it as a mainstay in our practice. And probably I have as many young ladies on Spiro as I do on Doxy.
That's just fascinating from a sort of historical perspective and how drugs develop. So something that was really built as a hypertension drug is now being used by you for acne and mm-hmm. being used for me for congestive heart failure.
And it works great.
Yeah.
For acne, it works great.
And it's a pretty safe drug. It raises your potassium level. You have to watch for
that.
Got
to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, but pretty safe drug.
It's like minoxidil.
Yeah.
Right? Invented as a blood pressure drug, and now we're using it at 1.25 or 2.5 milligrams for hair restoration.
Yeah, interesting.
It's a benign drug.
Yeah. So we're going to end this session with one last question. Actually, we'll do two questions. The serious question is that if we have pretty good treatments, do we need something new, or are there some limitations of the current treatments?
Like I was saying before, I really think that we're 20 years behind where we need to be in terms of acne treatment. I think we could be doing better, mm-hmm. and I think we owe it to our patients to do better. I don't think kids should have to be in a situation where they have to try 5 or 6 or 7 different regimens before we get to the sweet spot. Yeah. You know, they should be able to walk in, and we should be able to have an immediate slam dunk. In effect, I was having a discussion with another derm about this at the investigators meeting for the injection, and I was making the point that I think we're doing the best we can, but in all honesty, for our patient population, if we were doing the best that was out there, patients would not have to go on isotretinoin. Mm-hmm. Patients would not have to be on a spironolactone. We should be able to have an easy slam dunk mm-hmm. like we do now in the psoriasis world and atopic dermatitis world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so the not-so-serious question is, when we started this session, you were telling me that you hadn't done a podcast before.
I'm a first-time potter.
Right, and that you needed to be potty-trained.
I've been potty-trained.
So do you feel potty-trained at this point?
I feel very relieved.
Well, with that, we're going to end this session, and we look forward to you sticking with us for our next discussion on this really interesting topic.
Thanks for joining the MedEvidence Podcast. To learn more, head over to MedEvidence.com or subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform.